One moment, please.
Wednesday, January 21st. The beginning of another day in a world at war. During the next few minutes, we will hear from our on-the-spot reporters in England and in Washington. But first, news of the Far East from the San Francisco newsroom. The Dutch High Command reported today that, according to reliable reports, Japanese forces have occupied all of Minahassa, the northeastern arm of the island of Celebes, but paid dearly for this conquest. A Dutch lightship in the Strait of Malacca near Medan on Sumatra's east coast was bombed and machine gunned by three Japanese planes yesterday afternoon. It was announced in today's communique from the Netherlands Indies Armed Forces. According to the Dutch news agency ANETA, the planes attacked the lightship at the end of a reconnaissance flight in that area. No damage was reported. On the Malayan front, embattled Australian troops holding down the left flank of the Singapore defenses, only 60 miles from Johor Strait, struggle today to prevent new Japanese landings on the Malayan west coast, which might force them to retreat still further to avoid encirclement. Reports from the battle zone indicate the Japanese are applying heavy pressure on the entire front, but the danger that the invaders might be able to repeat their seaborne flanking tactics is causing most concern in Singapore. Bitter fighting raged all day yesterday along the narrow coastal strip between the mouth of the Moa River and Batu Bahat, some 30 miles to the south, with Imperial troops attempting to mop up Japanese forces which already had gained a foothold. Japanese planes flew low over the area, bombing and machine gunning in an effort to clear a path for their troops trying to filter southward through the jungles to menace British supply lines. On the east coast, Japanese patrols have succeeded in penetrating to Endau, about 75 miles from Singapore. But the pressure in this area is not so great as on the opposite side of the peninsula. It has been disclosed, meanwhile, that Japanese air raiders, which blasted at Singapore yesterday, doing some damage to military targets as well as residential areas, had caused civilian casualties of 50 killed and 150 injured. A dispatch just received from Melbourne, Australia, says that 20 Japanese fighters and 40 bombers attacked Kavieng on the Dutch island of New Guinea this morning, and a short time later, three more raiders bombed the nearby city of Madang. Strong Japanese aerial forces were sighted at a number of other places along the northern coast of New Guinea and over the Bismarck Archipelago. This evidently is an extension of operations instituted yesterday against Australian-mandated New Britain Island. The Bismarck Archipelago links New Britain and New Guinea. Defenders of Rabaul, New Britain base, are reported in a communique to have shot down three of 100 Japanese planes which struck there Tuesday. Over in Tokyo, Premier General Tojo told the Japanese Diet today that Japan, acting in close cooperation with Germany and Italy, plans increasing vigorous operations in the Pacific and will go on fighting until the United States and Britain have been brought to their knees. Tojo declared, and we quote him, "Japan intends to strengthen further her solidarity with her allies in military, diplomatic, economic, and various other spheres, and to go forward toward the attainment of a common purpose." He asserted Japan would gladly enable the Philippines to enjoy honor and independence, provided the Filipinos showed what he called a genuine willingness to collaborate in achieving common prosperity. In reference to Australia and the Netherlands East Indies, Tojo declared, "If they continue their present attitude of resisting Japan, we will show no mercy in crushing them." The Chinese press appealed today to the United States and Britain to institute a convoy system to rush huge quantities of war materials to China and also to extend credits to the Chungking government to facilitate its war effort. From Rangoon in Burma comes the word this morning that Thai Japanese forces, which launched a thrust from the Thailand border yesterday in the direction of the important port of Moulmein in southern Burma, have been checked near the frontier town of Miawadi. That's all from San Francisco. Next, to the newsroom in New York.
Back here in New York, we have a report that the newsroom here has received from Berlin, and it's to the effect that the German High Command admits that Russian forces broke through the Nazi lines yesterday, on the upper Donets River. Now, the Nazis claim the thrust was thrown back by counterattacks. The Germans claim today that revised figures show that more than 10,000 prisoners were taken when the Nazis took the Crimean port of Feodosia. And now our staff member in Great Britain is ready to report to us, and for news of that nation, we take you direct to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The situation in Malaya still looks very black. Authoritative quarters in London say the optimism that was beginning to creep into British papers isn't justified. The Japanese are making what are called very dangerous thrusts in the Muar River area toward the British north-south communications. They're putting strong air pressure on the British forces and are heavily attacking the road running southeast from Muar. It's understood in London that the British positions still lie about 70 to 75 miles from Singapore, but unofficially it's being pointed out that the Japanese are keeping up an average advance of about 25 miles a day. Unless the British can really bring serious opposition into the fight, the Japanese may be opposite Singapore Island by this weekend. British bombers last night attacked Emden in Germany. Many fires were left blazing. Four British planes are missing. It was announced today that the Archbishop of Canterbury, head of the Church of England, is retiring on March 31st. He said he felt a younger man is needed for the office. From time to time, there have been British complaints, usually from labor circles, that British propaganda aimed at the occupied countries hasn't taken a bold revolutionary line. The criticism is usually based on the opinion that millions of the conquered peoples would start active sabotage and uprisings against the Germans if they were given the pledge that they would have more say in post-war Europe. Of course, there's the other side of the picture. A lot of people who oppose the Germans want to see their countries re-established, but they wouldn't be happy at the thought of a social and economic upheaval. The British have found that the job of encouraging both groups is a difficult one. The difficulties are made greater by the fact that in Britain itself, there's sharp division over what line to take and what kind of Europe should come out of the war. For instance, should attempts be made to sway the leaders of Vichy France, or should the appeal be made directly to the French workers? Should the left-wing refugees whom the Nazis drove out of Germany and Austria be told to try to raise their countrymen to revolt, or should the propaganda be aimed at more conservative groups in Germany? British difficulties over what line to take have led to some strange situations. When the Russian trade union delegates speak at British workers' meetings, the British representatives usually sing the Internationale. But at an official football game the other day in aid of Russia, the British and the Yugoslav national anthems were played, and the Internationale wasn't, presumably because, although it's the Russian anthem, it's also an international revolutionary song. Last night, General de Gaulle, leader of the Free French, made a broadcast to France that definitely linked the French struggle for freedom with Russia. De Gaulle himself is not a politician, and nobody could call him a left-winger, but he declared that France must be an ally of Russia, and the necessity of this alliance had appeared at every turning point in history. You may remember that fear of the French working men helped influence men like Weygand and Pétain to surrender to Germany. De Gaulle said the traitors and cowards who delivered France to the enemy will protest that France's victory on the side of Russia means social upheaval in France. De Gaulle asserted that the French people scorned this protest as an insult, and said the French people know themselves well enough to understand that the choice of their regime will always lie with themselves. The French people, de Gaulle said, greet with enthusiasm the success of the Russian people, for now the liberation and vengeance of France have become pleasant probabilities. De Gaulle's broadcast was to have been made night before last, but it was held up for 24 hours. British official quarters gave a somewhat involved explanation for the delay. You might be interested in knowing that a friend of mine, a British nurse, was in a taxi the other day driving past a big red brick and concrete building, and the driver turned around to her and said, "There's the White House." She said, "What's that?" The driver said, "It's the American Embassy, but all us taxi drivers just call it the White House when we're talking among ourselves." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Back here in the United States, we're going to get a report on things at home, as given by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. You know, the labor unions have joined the ranks of the bloated, wealthy aristocrats, and the demand is made to find out what they're doing and stop it. You never would believe it, but this war is doing marvels, and today's marvel is the report of the Naval Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives, which really speaks of the concentration of wealth, using that term, in the treasuries of the labor unions of America. So much money that the Naval Affairs Committee recommends federal supervision over the labor union finances, and to soften that blow, which is certainly going to have a reaction, would also include the treasuries of other special groups, like Chambers of Commerce, for instance. The report is the result of a good going over of about 20,000 naval contracts, the contracts which are building the present terrific Navy, from battleships down, and in general, and in addition to that crack at labor, the Naval Affairs Committee of the House finds that profits in naval contracts are large enough to justify a good going over and a general trimming down. Several profits mentioned in the report were just too large for the committee to stand without yelping, and among them was the Bath Ironworks of Maine, said to be 29% profit on a destroyer contract, but the dispatches to Washington say that when the president of the works was told this, he said that that part of the report is just a plain lie. Somebody, he said, must have had the figures twisted. But there were some contracts, smaller contracts, where the profit was nearly 300%. Yet in general, as I went over this mass of figures, which is more than the figures in a telephone book, you'll find whole acres of figures showing profits of 7, 8, or 9%. I spoke to you yesterday about the Hertz report, which was not made public, and his recommendations or his plan for saving trucks and tires from the impact of careless drivers. I did not get that from Mr. Hertz, but got it from a congressional source. But the Army has its own way of improving that situation. Talking to Army people yesterday, I came to the conclusion that possibly a picture of a cavalryman and his horse might help. You know, American cavalry has made its own name, developed maneuvering and technique in the Civil War and the Indian Wars thereafter, and all through the larger aspects of cavalry runs the personal care each soldier gives to his horse, largely because he knows the horse has to take him there and back, and his life depends on the horse. Many people thought the cavalryman overdid this care. Well, I was thinking of this just yesterday, and I concluded, after talking to Army officers, that the same personalized individual care will be given to the thousands and tens of thousands of cars, jeeps, trucks, tanks, and other motor vehicles that this man's Army is building to invade the Axis and defeat the enemies on their own home grounds. The abuse of trucks and so forth by the new soldiers of the new Army, which really is bad, is going to be caught up with, and in fact it is and has been a headache, but it is being remedied in the Army's own manner. You know, it's worth considering. The American people will go into hysterics over the heroic glamour of naval and military activities. When there's war on, the public cheers, the band plays, the girls all fall for the boys in uniform. Remember, we changed our tune from I did not raise my boy to be a soldier to Over There. How quickly we cheered Douglas MacArthur for his really stupendous defense under odds that may never be known. And not long ago, many of his critics were just slam-banging him. We've been kept defended and kept from harm by this 150 years of American soldiers and sailors and Marines. I doubt of any better outfit in the world, and yet in this war and in every war, the Army and the Navy starts off its war by recurrent congressional investigations. Incidentally, the last family jalopy and the last private truck will roll off the line last of this month, so says Donald Nelson, the new production chief. After that, the mass production of the American motor car industry goes out and war production comes in, after about 6 months' delay for retooling and so forth, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Will Godwin. With the news from Washington, we conclude today's roundup of news at home and abroad. Other reporters on the program, our man in San Francisco, and John McVane from London. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.